One of the hardest things to admit to other people is that you're lonely. To me, it feels like there's a stink to it. It's like cooties in grade school. If you label yourself as lonely in front of other people, it feels like the worst thing you could do, which might be why, even though the former Surgeon General called out that in the US we're suffering from a loneliness epidemic, it doesn't feel like the problem has gone away. Which is why for the next two episodes of our Pandora's Box, we're taking on the subject of friendship, starting at a macro level through what social science says about Americans and loneliness, and finishing the exploration through a conversation with someone who's out there on the ground helping people make friends. If you're new here, I'm Maria Iliadis, your elder millennial sister and host of our Pandora's Box. On every episode, we're tackling the biggest issues in the US right now so you can lead a life that is true to you, cutting through the mess we're living in through advice from vetted experts. With all that I just said about loneliness, I believe that friends are the rock of our world, even if you have a significant other. Our friends come in ranges. Some are chosen family. Others are the people we see during our hobbies. Some are the ones you've known since you were 11. And others are the ones that you just met in this season of life. Whoever they are, you know they're important. But maybe also the friends that you have just don't seem enough for where you are. So that's why I'm opening this two-parter with a conversation with Dr. Natalie Pennington. Dr. Pennington is Associate Professor of Communication Studies at Colorado State University. Her work looks at how we talk to one another, how we interact, and what that means across societies, organizations, and groups, especially through social media and technology. I really wanted to have this conversation with her because she's been one of the co-leads on what is trying to be the most comprehensive study yet on friendship in the US, called the American Friendship Project. So let's talk to her to find out what the data says about friendships in the US and what we can do to make better and stronger friendships. Well, I'm really excited today to welcome on Dr. Natalie Pennington. Dr. Pennington, welcome to our Pandora's Box.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So to start out, could you describe yourself in your 20s?
20-year-old Natalie was very social. I was a college student through the totality of it because undergrad into grad school. So I also moved three times during that as well from undergrad to each school I went to. A very busy person is probably the best word I would use for that. I worked all through undergrad as well, in addition to going to school, and then traveled for, I was a debater.
Did you have a favorite place you traveled to during that time?
You know, what was fun with it is I got to go to some places each year. So it was fun to go back to them. So you kind of built some routines around that. And then just the people I got to see. But, you know, when you said it, the first thing I thought of was San Francisco. I got to go there two different times and it was just stunning getting to drive along. And I'd never seen the ocean because I'm from the Midwest. And then I got to go for a conference a few years later. And so just exploring, walking around Chinatown, just getting to see the city. It was beautiful.
There are so many places that make an impression on us when we're, especially, I think, younger.
I agree with that.
Yeah, and a lot of changes. And the topic we're focusing on today is friendship. In the age of AI and technology, loneliness, and how to make and keep friends as an adult. And I know a lot of your studies have focused on young adults, on people in their 20s. It feels like the loneliness crisis is being covered all over the news for a while now. But your research for the American Friendship Project found that Americans actually have friends. So what's going on there? What are we actually talking about when we're highlighting a loneliness crisis?
It's such a good question because it was one of the first things when we started the American Friendship Project we wanted to understand was, is there a crisis? What is it? Or is the crisis a question of, do people have enough friends? And there were absolutely headlines that I think led us to think people don't have as many friends. And in fact, like you said, our study found three different years now that the number of people who say, I have absolutely no friends, is really quite small. And people are also actually pretty happy with the number of friends they have. The concerns that happen and where we get some of this loneliness epidemic is the quality of our friendships. People want more time to spend with their friends. They want to be able to hang out with them, and they're feeling that pressure. And that's when we start to feel lonely.
You've worked a lot with Dr. Jeffrey Hall, who has estimated how long it actually takes to be, you know, an acquaintance, a more solid friend, a close friend. And you just highlighted time.
Yeah.
And that leads me to my next question. So having time as an adult is a huge challenge. Do you have any recommendations based on that work, the research that you've done, or even your personal life on how people can make the time that they need to have those, it sounds like, satisfying friendships?
It's such a good point, and I love that you bring up Jeff's study. It's such a good one. How many hours to make a friend? He did look at college students, but he also thought, you know, broader life experiences. And I teach about this in my classes too. And I say, you know, it's 50 hours to just move from acquaintance to I'm calling them a friend. And it can take 250 to 300 hours to call someone a best friend. But it's not just the time piece, right? It's part of it, because then I'll also be like, who's worked a 40-hour work week? And suddenly you hit that 250 pretty quick, but you're not friends with everybody you work with. So a big part of what Jeff's study says, and a lot of the work that I do as somebody who studies communication, is we got to talk to people. So making sure that even if we don't have time, there's ways we could reach out and connect. If you've got a little time between things and you're scrolling Instagram reels or TikTok, when it makes you think of somebody, send it to them. Tell a friend you're thinking about them. And that can be one part to start to, especially if you haven't talked in a while, open things up. Get you talking to each other. Another piece of advice I'd offer on the time question is that when you do have free time, ask people to get together. Somebody was just saying this at an event I was doing yesterday here on campus. It's new student orientation week. And they were like, you know, it never leaves the group chat. I absolutely fell prey to this in one of my own group chats last week that was like, let's get brunch. And we're like, yeah, we should totally get brunch. And then nobody ever actually plans anything. And so the advice on that is be exact. So like, oh, hey, let's go have brunch on Friday. Who's in? Right? Oh, I'm going to this event. Anybody want to join me? You put yourself out there and be specific with things. If you're just like, generally, anybody want to get together, you might keep going back and forth.
That sounds like a good way of establishing frequency and maybe some of the intimacy that's required to feel like closer friends. But I'm wondering again about that closeness piece, especially with transitions. How can people establish closer friendships? It feels like with this loneliness crisis and your research, the people are looking for their ride or dies.
I do think that's right. I'll go back to his study to say, don't put so much pressure on yourself and the other person right away, right? You meet someone and you're like, oh my gosh, they seem really cool. We get all in our heads, wait, they didn't text me back, or oh, do they actually like me? People tend to be thinking about themselves more as a piece of it. So just acknowledge you're not going to be best friends overnight. It does take time. And if that's only little bits you can give here and there, then it might take you a year or longer to move from casual acquaintance to really good friends. But it is that consistent building on. So if there is somebody that you want to be better friends with, you want that greater intimacy, then being vulnerable to acknowledge, hey, I'm going to share. And when we share about ourselves, people tend to share in response. So it creates that reciprocity in our relationships that helps us move through, we call them stage models of relationship development. So the more depth of disclosures we share, the closer we can feel. But it's also about the breadth of topics. So if you are in a book club, I'm totally in a book club, and if all you ever do in those book clubs is talk about the book, you're never going to get that closer intimacy with people. The book club's a great starting point. You've got a shared interest. I love a psychological thriller. But while we're there, we can turn and talk with someone about, oh, like, what's something you cooked this week? Or how's your family doing? And build on and get more topics you talk about, and then greater depth of things as well.
Can you tell me more about those stages?
Oh, yeah. It's fun. It's one of the, I would say, oldest theories that exist in communication studies, like 1970s old. It was part of my dissertation. It's called social penetration theory. People are like onions. They have layers. Are similar to the Shrek ogres, onions, layers, right? The theory argues that we can peel away these layers to reach different levels of intimacy in our relationships, and that our breadth, again, variety of topics we talk about, the facets of things, but also the depth that we go on some of those topics can help us signal moving from that more acquaintance level. So it's exploratory effective exchange, stable exchange. And stable is like really my closest couple people in my life. And very few people make it there. And in fact, one of the big things the theory pushes is that exploratory effective exchange is where most relationships end up. We aren't close with most people. So the very first one is orientation. The very first time you meet someone, right? You and I had a talk the other day, so it was orientation. Mm-hmm. So technically now, as we're talking more, you and I are in the exploratory affective, and then moving to those last two stages would require a lot more variety of topics we talk about, greater depth of topics, and then it's your really, really close individuals in your life that are in the stable.
I'm wondering and thinking how much the pandemic affected that, you know, what you've found in your research and also your time with your students of how that has changed friendship.
The student piece really was heartbreaking for me during the pandemic, both as a professor and then somebody who studies these topics and interviewing and talking to students who felt like they didn't know how to be social anymore. They were like, I'm terrified when I am going to go back to campus of how I'm even supposed to figure out how to ask people to hang out. One of the longest reaching things that we've seen, both in the research we've done with American Friendship Project, but other public facing data too, is that people aren't inviting people into their homes as much anymore. And so when we think about that question, we're like, we want to spend more time with our friends, but we don't host dinner parties. Yeah. We don't have like movie nights. We don't have game nights. And those were much more prevalent 7 years ago. And so it's sad to me to see that those are our trade-offs that happen. And so while we have a shift now to things are more in person, we still see the social ramification. And I think that's true of public spaces too. Like people who maybe used to go out all the time. Like, do you go to the club still? Do you go out to public spaces, or are you worried about getting sick? And that spills over to time with people and being social. And then we stay in our houses. And, you know, if you've got a family, amazing, great. But that's only a piece of it. And it's the acknowledgement that we need to have different people in our lives who serve different roles and inviting them in.
Yeah, exactly. I went and reread a little bit of the Surgeon General's report in 2023 about recommendations of how to overcome the loneliness crisis that he highlighted. And a piece of that was community organizations making space for people, government on multiple levels of doing that. That public space piece is really, really striking. I've noticed in New York, we've had, it feels like this really nice revival of these outdoor concerts over the summer and movies and things like that. And that is a space. It's not enough of a recurring space for people to meet each other, but it is at least a public space where the barrier to entry is, well, it's free. So it doesn't matter what your income is. But I'm wondering about, just with the US and compared to other places, that added challenge of a lot of places have gotten privatized. So the spaces where people can hang out has gotten so limited.
Third spaces.
Exactly. Those third spaces.
Yeah. You know, I just worked with a really fantastic graduate student where he interviewed and talked to people who had moved, not for school, but for a job in the past 3 years. I just wanted to learn about how they built a new community in a space, right? And one of his biggest takeaways was it's not just about the people, but about the space and the place itself. And overwhelmingly for the people he talked to, it was how did they find or create community? So there was some who said, you know, I found a new yoga studio and I want to exercise and do yoga anyway. And now because I keep going back, I start to meet and talk to people. But to your point, it could cost quite a bit depending on where you at and where you live. There were absolutely people who talked to as well who felt like they were really struggling with building that community. They were like, there aren't spaces or places for me that feel comfortable or familiar. And that's a problem. I'll say a really cool shout out I'll make is that there were some researchers in Canada who brought a big group of us together worldwide to create social connection guidelines that were situated as, what are things individuals can do for social connection? What are things that, like, the community, but also the government levels? Some of these things are very individualized, so I can offer advice on what I can do, but also there's constraints on where I live. And we see that in our American Friendship Project data, where people said, okay, I'm sad about the time I can spend. So we asked them, well, what are the barriers? And they're very real things, right? I don't have a car. I don't have enough money. And sometimes it is the, you know, I just don't have time. Mm-hmm. But there are like actual structural constraints that make it hard for them. And so I do think it's on communities and to some extent local governments to create those spaces or to protect those spaces when they do exist for people of different age groups to be able to come together. And it's not just something where you have to pay to be a part of it.
That's a great report to have of making these recommendations and thinking about it an international, but I suppose North American level because of the ways in which we socialize and the ways in which Canada and the United States are built, are physically built, to then say, okay, based on how car-centric we are, with rare exceptions, how do we work with this?
It's really cool. I'll make sure I'll send you a link to it. They have it posted online and it's got lots of really practical tips for people and also shares cool case studies of times where a community had something that worked really well. I remember seeing one on there that was about if we go to the what's something we can do for free. And certainly in my community, this is true too. There's ways we can do stuff out in public spaces that don't require us to spend money.
I'm going to shift gears. I have a
Sure.
question actually from a listener that I think relates a lot to one of your studies about the loneliness among young adults because of life changes. So I'm going to let the listener take this away.
Hi, Dr. Pennington. My name is Nina. My question is about long-term friendships, the friendships we start in either childhood, early adolescence, and then move into early adulthood, mid to late adulthood. How do we know whether these friendships have naturally evolved and simply just taken a different season of life, or contrarily, fundamentally change and we end up holding on because of past history? And more specifically, how has technology and our ability now to be able to call, FaceTime, text, keep tabs on our friends, see how they're doing, how has that played a factor in whether or not we're able to determine whether the friendship has naturally run its course?
Oh my God, I love that question. You know, when I think about that, it immediately made me think of a couple different studies I've done. I'll go pre-tech on this because I think technology is a big part of it. So, Facebook launched my freshman year of college. So, I have a lot of people I managed to then from high school I got connected to because our freshmen were like, oh my gosh, everybody adds everybody. And you wrote like how you met somebody and how you knew each other. But Facebook's been around for 22 years now. And so I have people who I'm Facebook friends with, who I knew in high school, who I have absolutely not talked to in the past 22 years. We call this virtual tie signs. We have this connection that exists digitally because we both agreed to be friends, but we don't ever actually talk to each other. And so if technology didn't exist, we would call this a dormant or a commemorative tie. So there's a really fantastic friendship researcher, William Rollins, and he had pitched this idea of thinking about our friendships as active, dormant, or commemorative. And so your listener sort of said, like, is this about a season of my life? And that's like exactly what this is. Commemorative are the, if you went to a day camp or a summer camp for a few weeks and you connected, or for a lot of people, high school. And we might look back on those things fondly and what they represented, but they are more commemorative for us because we're not actually actively talking to them. And we aren't maybe even interested in reactivating that connection. The dormant friends are then that weird space where you also probably have people from high school and possibly camps and other spaces who you would reconnect with, but you're not actively talking to right now. And so that's where you place them in that. I wouldn't call it a friendship, but maybe I could. I'm inactive the people I'm actually interacting with and calling friends right now in my life. I think social media really blurred this line of dormant and commemorative, where in the past, relationships just fell away. If you move to a new place and you didn't have cell phones for texting and you didn't have social media, and unless you like actively shared and knew each other's addresses or something beforehand, you just kind of let those relationships go. And we were okay with that, and that was normal. But now, because we add everybody in different ways, suddenly we can stay digitally connected, and that might cause us to feel the pressure to stay emotionally invested otherwise. And sometimes that's great because we really do want to, and other times it's a pressure thing. I think tech is the issue, also a delightful solution. And you got to internally ask yourself, is this somebody I really want to be friends with? If it's you are just doing this because it's a question of pressure, it's okay to let friendships go. Sometimes they are just commemorative. They represent a certain time period for us, a moment, a season of our life. There are absolutely people who I was friends with in my 20s that I am not friends with now. And I'm okay with that. And I look back on those friendships fondly, wonderful humans, but we were there for each other then, and now I'm in a different space.
Our Pandora's Box is produced by Pentelic Productions, an independent podcast and strategic marketing company that I founded to help organizations and experts turn big ideas into thoughtful, compelling audio that connects with listeners like you. Have a complex idea or a concept that you think would be great for a podcast, but don't know how to pull it off or don't have the staff to do it in-house? Get in touch with us at pentelicproductions.com. We'll help you find the clarity, narrative, and strategy to make it happen. That's Pentelic, Pentelic Productions. And now, back to the show. I'm wondering also, now that AI is actually very useful, But I'm sure you've also read the articles about people falling in love with their AIs, building friendships around them. What do you think this can actually do for friendship? And what are things that it can't do?
It makes me nervous, if I'm being completely honest. And I think part of that is my role as a teacher. It makes me nervous. But interpersonally, and the emphasis I have on relationships and friendships, it's so funny. Literally sitting on my desk next to me right here, my college just put out new hats for our college that are 100% human. We really try to push that piece. And so what I'll say is I think the reason why we can't consider AI a friend is that AI is built to flatter you. Mm-hmm. It's built to agree with you. And so even if it might offer a contradictory point at one point, if you correct it, it will just, oh yeah, you're right. It was this thing. And when we're trying to complete a task, we have to correct it. It messes up. It messes up a lot. But from an interpersonal friendship, we want our friends to be honest with us, right? Like we literally asked in the American Friendship Project, what are the most important characteristics you have in a friend? And honesty was one of the most common answers that people gave. AI will not be honest with you. It's just not going to happen. And so I think it's a poor substitute for what social relationships can offer. It's good for us to have a broad network of people that we can interact with and enjoy low stakes conversations with. You know, just go out and talk to another human, and that will be better for your connection than just AI being like a yes man for you.
But there is a genuine part of American culture that is not good with confrontation or discomfort. And that's a very difficult thing with friendships. And AI gives you zero discomfort.
It is totally the easy answer. And I agree with you. I think that we, again, there's a fear of upsetting someone, of being vulnerable, of what if they don't like me? Mm-hmm. I can't actually say that thing. A lot of impression management and self-management that goes into things. And technology absolutely, I think, made that worse, right? When we talk about some of the effects of social media that cause us to be crafting this sense of self online and very performative, that it then makes us nervous to be like, wait, mm-hmm. but actually, this is what I think. And then being okay that someone else is like, I don't think that. And that's okay too. And we don't have to agree with our friends about every single thing. But you got to get to a point to be okay with that. So what I would offer is any type of technology and the work that Jeff and I have done, at least, if you're like literally not talking to a single person and getting zero social connection, then there's a chance that a conversation with a chatbot that's trained appropriately could start to help you a little. And my reference point for this is we know texting is something people love to do. People love to text message. Jeff and I have actually found pretty consistently that texting is actually not that great for us, even though we do it all the time.
Oh, why is that?
So it's expectations related to it. For a lot of people, we might have an expectation that someone's supposed to respond right away, but it is not a synchronous form of communication. Right? You and I are like, you said that and I got to answer you right away. But texting can give that illusion. So that's very hard if you're texting and then somebody just doesn't answer. Even though we've gotten all these great new emojis or the use of GIFs you can use, or people get creative with their use of all caps or elongate something or reactions that you can do. Mm. We make efforts to decrease miscommunication, but it's considered a lean medium comparatively right now. You and I see each other. And it's not just that there's no time delay, but I see your face, you see my face. We hear our voices as we say things. I'm a hand talker, and so my hand's moving. And we miss those things in a text-based medium. And so while it's great to quickly send a message, the risk of miscommunication can be so high that it's just not as satisfying. But the trade-off is that we know if somebody's, again, particularly lonely, really struggling, having a hard time, research is definitely showing just sending a text, if that's all you've got the energy for, then we're never going to tell you not to send the text. Mm-hmm. If you've got the time and opportunity, the one that we push that's really wonderful is phone calls. And I feel like our generation is terrified of the phone, and I don't know why. We just called. The phone call just kind of fell by the wayside. And before that, email. Email used to be a very social, and now I think both of them are kind of represented by, honestly, the blurred boundaries of technology. Mm-hmm. So communication technology can be used with our friends, with our family, but it is also 90% of the phone calls that I get on my phone are spam calls, phishing attempts, or scheduling appointments or meetings. And the same thing with my email is overwhelmed with all of those things. But when they were first introduced and a part of our daily lives, they were encouraged to be interpersonally social.
Yeah.
One of the things people critique about texting is texting really long messages to each other. And I'm like, that's basically an email. And I'm like, well, but emails are still good, right? And letter writing is good. There are really cool initiatives with in-person stationery stores creating pen pals for people.
Oh, I love that.
I know. I think it's so cool. A friend, she actually also worked with Jeff and got her doctorate. She's in North Carolina, opened a stationery store, Athena's in Winston-Salem, and she's a part of it. But it's an international initiative. I think actually the store that originally did it was in the UK. But people can come into the store and pick out stationery and write letters to people. And it just encourages us to go back to that more longer form style of communication. And that's what emails can offer. But we sign up for the coupons from the store, and then it's just your email is not personal anymore. Phone calls not the same way.
So texting, not necessarily bad.
Yeah.
Phone calls are better. What about voice notes?
I love it. I haven't seen a study about it yet. And I'll say it's got to be my next one, Maria. Like, I got to include it because it's come up a lot with my students. I think it's such a perfect blend of, right, where we said part of the problem that's lost with a text message is that leanness where you don't hear the voice and the sense of something. And sometimes when you want to tell a friend a funny story, it's just easier to tell you about it, but then acknowledges those tensions that exist with time. We can't get together. Maybe we live in different time zones, right? My brother is in New York, I'm in Colorado, and my sister is in Missouri. And so we were in three different time zones. Before I was here, I was in Vegas, so I was even further time zone away. And so I think about those times where we wanted to connect, that could have been a really creative way for us to interact with each other. And we didn't use it, but I'm seeing it come up more and more often. And I think it's really cool as an in-between, right? Yeah. And I would suspect from a research perspective that we would see that it's more valuable. And I think that's the thing with any tech is we just have to negotiate those boundaries. Jeff did a really cool study with Nancy Baim. She was like one of the very first people to ever say, you can have relationships on the internet. She did her dissertation about soap opera listservs in the 90s, which I think is so cool. They looked at mobile maintenance expectations. And so I think voice notes, we could say the same way, where if you and your friends all like to use them, amazing. And then just being on the same page about what it means to use them and what they look like, and then they're going to be really good for you. But if nobody around you uses them, it can be harder to adopt.
Yeah. And harder to get people around you to adopt.
Yeah.
So after you've been studying friendship professionally for so long, is there anything that you've changed about the way that you approach your own friendships?
You know, I do try to adopt a lot of the things that I'm offering as advice. I have the great friend of mine who we are always sending each other the We Rate Dogs on Instagram, who can send it to each other first. We used to work together. We haven't worked together in, I think like 7 or 8 years now. You know, you send the meme and then you start chatting with each other and catching up. We both live in different time zones, so we know we're not going to talk right away. So trying to, you know, give myself grace and others grace, right? I did go through a period where, because I was studying especially social media and this frustration about the virtual tie signs, I like deleted a ton of people from my social media and cut it really tight for a period. I'm actually a little sad I did that, because I've decided that it's okay to have some people hang out there because I could reactivate them. They could, you know, move to more active friendships. I would say today that unless you're actually like, no, this friendship is done and it's good and I'm over it, that it doesn't hurt to have people as parts of your broader network that you could reactivate later. I definitely think that it has affected how I use technology more than anything. I have always been a lover of email. Me and my brother send long emails to each other and have always enjoyed it. And I've tried to be a little bit more active in that. And then to talk to people. I'm totally an introvert, Maria. Like, and people are like, I don't believe. I'm like, I'm a teacher, so I have to stand in front of rooms of people. Yeah. But like at the end of the day, I am not a aggressively social person. And so I do try to make sure that I get out of the house and talk to people, and not the same exact people. And if I'm out buying a coffee, I say hi, just little things where I'm like, oh, hey, that thing's cool. And just see where it takes you when you talk to people. I'll also say I've moved a lot as an adult. So that was one where I really had to practice what I preach of it all when it comes to building new relationships, because it's harder each time. Right after my PhD, I worked in the same community space for 3 years. So I had a really beautiful network. And then my husband and I moved across the country and we had nobody there. Our family was all the other side of the country, everybody, New York, Pennsylvania, Midwest, and we were in Las Vegas and knew no one. And so I had to start fresh. And I think that being able to know things like, it's just going to take time and I can't just magically have a best friend here and be okay with that. I built some really amazing friendships there. And then we had a chance to get closer to family and landed here in Colorado. And each time I think it's gotten, you know, it's same thing like exercising, stretching the muscle. I've done it a few times now. Yeah. And so I knew what worked when I moved and made those friendships, and what can I be doing now here and building relationships, and the different types of friendships and knowing there's different people is really nice.
I've also moved a couple of times, sometimes more drastically than others. And what strikes me on the most recent move, because I moved back up to New York, which is where I'm from, is how much it actually takes out of me to reestablish friendships or to make new friendships. Because as I have moved, I have gotten older, people around me have gotten older. And it struck a chord when I was reading some of your research about the transitions. You step out of what is those times of a lot of structure and people being open to friendship. And then it gets to be a lot harder to make those friends when you do those transitions. And I would gather it's a very common experience, but we don't talk about it.
It's crazy to me we don't talk about it too. There's cool US census data that while Americans are moving less often than they used to in the past, they are moving at greater distances.
Interesting.
And so that's where, right, in part of what my grad student that just finished his thesis was really interested in, they had to move at least an hour away from where they previously lived to be interviewed. So really saying, like, this is disrupting your social network.
Yeah.
Like, what do we do? How do we, and the tension between, I can just talk to all my old friends, but no, actually I need to be in this space and actually be a part of this community if I want to build towards something. And so I'm excited that I think more people are acknowledging that. You know, one thing I'll throw out there, every time I do these types of talks, I say, sometimes I think we put so much pressure on the person who's new. And I'll get people who are listening. So like, I hope you have listeners who have actually probably maybe lived in their communities for a really long time. And that's amazing that you get to be in this space and maybe you have a fantastic network, but maybe you get a new neighbor or you get a new colleague and that person needs people. So invite them for a coffee or check in and see how they're doing or drop something by their door at their house to say hello and welcome to the neighborhood, because it's so much harder for the new person than it is for the people who are already there, and you can help make that easier. And so being open to those new relationships instead of saying like, I have my friends, I'm good. Well, but we had people moving to new spaces all the time and we can be there and support each other.
And it is a lot on the new person to do it. I mean, maybe this is a new cultural call as a reminder to meet your neighbors.
And, you know, we could circle back. You mentioned this earlier about the community piece of it, because I do think there's such interesting conversations that the loneliness epidemic might also be about a very individualized, self-focused society. That if we have more sense of community and sense of belonging, not just individually and in my like little social circle, but in the spaces and places that I'm at, right? Mm-hmm. Like I am a part of this thing, then that can also really bring us together and have the shared cause or interest, or in this case, my shared neighborhood, right? And those things can be really nice for us. Absolutely know your neighbors. You know, one other thing I'll throw out that is also true about this time period, when we're thinking about millennial women, is also the growing number of people who choose to, for whatever reason, either not be married or not have children. And so an increase in the United States and globally of people choosing to be single and totally happy with it, and that's amazing, or choosing to, if they are partnered, not have kids. And those things also make this increasingly harder each time, because I am somebody who is happily married but is not have children, is totally fine with that, get to spoil the nieces and nephews. But that adds a layer when you move to a new space, right? Because people can build community around their kids, friends, and parents, friends with parents. And so that makes it a little bit harder. And then even more so for somebody who might not move with a partner, right? I'm lucky that each time I moved, I had Joe with me as a support system. And so for those people, friendship becomes especially important.
And it'll be interesting to see over time what happens now that it is so much more common to either not be married or not have children, and how that affects our social spaces and maybe also how we decide to change things as a result.
I'm hopeful for that. I think we should acknowledge that people have different goals in life and different ways of which they envision and think of what is family, what does it mean to belong, what does it mean to be part of a community. Our current society is just a tiny sliver of the whole of how people have lived in relation to each other. And so there are models in other countries and in history that might be worth thinking about in terms of how we socially interact and connect with each other. And so I think that especially, you know, it makes me hopeful for Gen Z and younger folks that we're seeing pretty consistent evidence that if you're like asking them to rank what's most important to me in life, we're seeing a shift where it's actually, you know, I value friendship. And as somebody who studies friendship, I'm like, yes, please value it. It's important.
What's next for the American Friendship Project and your research?
So for the American Friendship Project, we're really excited to start thinking about, now we have 3 years of descriptive data about how people think about friendship, and we've started to ask, you know, slightly different questions each year. We're looking towards intervention, so specifically around that life change piece. So saying young adults who enter into the job force, right, whether that's right after high school and don't go to college, because we also know college attendance is declining, or graduate college and start a job, how can we provide preventative tools so that when they encounter that, oh no, I'm in a new space, that they feel prepared to work with that, like a checklist of sorts. So we're going to play around with some of those things. We're really excited. Amanda Holmstrom is the third person who works on this with us, and she got a grant from her University of Michigan State for us to look into that piece of it. So we're pretty excited. And then broadly with the research I'm doing, also looking at friendships that end and how we navigate those and make choices and whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. And family group chats.
Okay.
Really excited about.
I always ask my guests for recommendations on things that they think our listeners should read, watch, or listen in order to be more informed about the topic. You've given us a couple of great recommendations, but what else would you recommend that people read to better understand friendships and the tending of friends?
So I'll shout out The Atlantic and Julie Beck.
Okay.
She actually had a whole series called The Friendship Files that she did for quite a long time for them that just spotlighted people's everyday experiences with friendship and different types of friendship, you know, raised the question of what if friendship and not romantic relationships was the center of our world and what would that look like? And they did some podcast episodes about that. And I think she had like some summary pieces as it wrapped up too. Ali Volpe, also amazing person who does a bunch of really cool work, often with Vox about friendship. And what I love about her is that she's somebody who goes and does and reads the academic published research and then makes it very accessible to the public. The last one I'll shout out, I think it's on my bookshelf at home, Jeff's book, The Social Biome, him and Andy Marola, adore both of them. And I think that that's such a great book that is highlighting, like I said, it's this whole world we have of network of people, and the social biome tries to address and think about that broadly.
Amazing. Well, Dr. Pennington, thank you so much for this conversation today. The time just flew by.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really fun.
If you want to find out more about Dr. Pennington's work, the American Friendship Project, or the resources we mentioned at the end of the episode, visit the Our Pandora's Box Substack and make sure you subscribe to never miss a thing. Today, I want to give a big thank you to our Substack and Patreon supporters, Victor Salazar and Carrie Donahue. And I also want to thank you for listening today. Join us again in 2 weeks for the second part of this conversation on friendship and loneliness in the U.S. with Alexandra Friedman, a friendship coach and the creator of Connection Fest in Seattle, Washington. Our Pandora's Box is a Pentelic Productions podcast that was created, hosted, produced, and edited by yours truly, Maria Iliadis. Remember to stay hopeful and stay curious. I'll see you soon on the next Our Pandora's Box.